Well, we moved this morning into part two of a two-part sermon that I began last Sunday. Don't worry if you weren't here, because I'll get you caught up. Spent a fair amount of time in last Sunday's sermon establishing that our American culture is going downhill morally, and this can be seen in a variety of ways across the spectrum of human interaction and behavior. I'm not going to repeat myself on that subject here today. My guess is I don't have to convince you that we live in a troubled society full of anger and division and anxiety and shifting ethics. I will say this, though. One significant change from past eras of American thinking is how our overall culture looks at Christians. This change was described well by a pastor I heard speak at a Converge conference this past fall in the Twin Cities. The pastor was in his 60s, I would guess, and he came into a relationship with Jesus later in his life. Prior to that, he had been quite a partier and drinker. When he gave his life over to Jesus and received the grace and love of God, he stopped drinking. He said that when his drinking buddies found out that he was a Christ follower and that he no longer drank, he says that they looked at him as being a goody-goody, right? In their mind, someone who was overly concerned with morals. Here's the difference between then and today. Today, this pastor said, if you become a Christ follower and your non-Christ-following friends find out, instead of looking at you as someone who's overly concerned about morality, they actually might look at you as someone who has embraced an immoral position. American culture has shifted in how it looks at Christians. I actually experienced this in a very small way right before we came to Madison, and most of you know this is my first pastorate. I worked in the financial world prior to coming here, which will be 7 years ago this coming spring. When I put in my two-week notice at Ameriprise Financial in Minneapolis back then, and I began to tell people that I had taken a job as a pastor, one of my friends there emailed to say goodbye to me, and within his nice goodbye, he also wrote that he hoped I would not be the normal kind of pastor, because do you know what Christian pastors teach about such and such and such? And he was right about what Christian pastors teach about those things. He felt that Christian pastors taught immoral things. So that's a change for us, Christ followers, how American society looks at us. So views on morality in all kinds of departments are changing, moving away from a biblically based morality, and correspondingly then, views on the people who are following the Bible are also changing. And so my two-part sermon here is designed as a short look at this new situation we find ourselves in, fellow Christ followers, and it's designed to give us some pointers on how to live and act within that new situation. Now, if we would have the thought that we were the first people, the first Christ followers, to live in a scenario where the greater culture around us disagreed with our moral beliefs, and perhaps might even be hostile to Christians, we would be overwhelmingly incorrect in that thought, right? So many have gone before us who have had to figure out how to conduct themselves as Christians within morally lost cultures. I think of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a German Christian pastor in the World War II era who protested against the actions of the Nazi regime. He paid for it with his life. We could think of Don and Carol Richardson, who deliberately chose to live among a morally lost culture. The Sawi tribes of New Guinea, who were known for being cannibals. This missionary couple had to figure out how to live within a morally lost culture. So, and there are all kinds of names we could come up with if we tried, of Christians who lived in really difficult situations. The good news from that is that we can go back and look at some of those people now, and we can learn from them on how they did it. That's my goal in this two-week sermon. Last Sunday morning, we used Martin Luther King Jr. as our example. Martin Luther King Jr. lived within a dominant white culture, many of whom had gone crazy with the immoral belief that African Americans were inferior and that they perhaps should be beaten or killed if they sat in the front of the bus or used a drinking fountain that had been labeled for white people, etc. And so he had to determine how to go about living as a Christ follower in that morally lost situation. Now, Martin Luther King Jr. wasn't a perfect human being. He had his flaws and his sins. We all have our flaws and sins. He did, however, many, many things very well, and so we found that we could take some pointers from him. We drew 4 points from his teaching and actions that I believe are good guides for us today. And these ideas from Dr. King came out of his study of the Bible. I'll just recap them for you in case you missed last Sunday. Here they are. Number one, we ought to respond to madness around us by staying calm, though that does not mean staying quiet. The Bible says we are to speak the truth in love. We're to speak the truth. That means we don't have to stay quiet. We can speak truth. But when we do so, we ought to speak in love, it says. And that can be a very different thing. Bible also teaches that we are to be slow to become angry. Quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry. And by leading nonviolent protests, Martin Luther King Jr. acted these things out in a profound and powerful way. So we ought to respond to madness around us by staying calm, though that does not mean staying quiet. His second suggestion was that we are to show love and respect to all, even to those we are battling ideologically with. It's a similar thought to the first suggestion there. We heard Dr. King teach on this last Sunday. And of course, the Bible instructs us, we know, to love our neighbors as ourselves, even to love our enemies. So we are to show love and respect to all, even to those we are battling ideologically with. Third suggestion was that we need to be willing to suffer for the right. There may come a time when we might have to suffer in order to stand up for God and for righteousness. I hope not. But if that time comes, we need to be willing to suffer, just as so many Christ followers have been willing before us, even Christ himself. Finally, the fourth suggestion from Dr. King that we looked at last Sunday was that we should never give up hope. We should never give up on the vision for a better day coming ahead. There's always hope with God, and so we hold on to that. 4 great suggestions for us to be thinking about as we live our lives in an American culture that's moving away from the Bible and its teachings. Well, today we turn our attention to another example of a Christ follower from the past, who lived in a morally lost culture, and we'll look just a bit at how he lived and what he taught about how to live in that type of situation. We turn our attention now to the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul, along with many of the Christ followers of his day, suffered plenty due to their dedication to Jesus. And it wasn't just at the hands of the Jews. As the New Testament ends, Paul is sitting in a prison in Rome. Scholars are fairly certain that he was killed some years later during what is called the Nero persecution. If that era of people could be labeled morally lost, then the Roman Emperor Nero was the right leader for the time. Even by the standards of the day, he was judged to be off his rocker. A fire ravaged much of Rome under his watch, and when suspicion turned on him, as actually having been the one who perhaps had started the fire, he found a convenient scapegoat, Christians. He knew that Christians were not well liked in his empire since they did not worship the local gods or participate in the popular social gatherings and feasts that were that revolved around the worship of those idols. So Nero blamed the fire on the Christians. The historian Tacitus wrote about what followed. Those who confessed that they were Christians were arrested, and on the basis of their testimony, a great number were condemned. Before killing the Christians, Nero used them to amuse the people. Some were dressed in furs to be killed by the dogs. Others were crucified. So despite the fact that the Christians essentially were simply preaching a message of love, the Roman authorities, like Nero and others who followed him, often had them brutally murdered. This craziness was not confined to the Roman authorities in those days either. That big stadium of theirs in Rome, the Colosseum, amazing structure, opened just a few years after Nero lived. Well, it wasn't for football. It was regularly used for watching people who had gotten in trouble with the establishment be killed and eaten by lions and other wild creatures. This is what the Romans did for entertainment. Talk about a morally lost culture. So this is the world that Paul was living in. And if you've read the New Testament to some depth, you'll know that he didn't just face persecution, but Paul was regularly confronting the fact that there were people coming into the very churches that he had founded with all kinds of false ideas and teachings. Some of these people had been telling the church members that since Jesus died to eliminate the consequence for sin, they could now sin as much as they wanted. And there were some of the church members who thought that sounded okay, and they caught on to that idea and were doing things like, one specific thing mentioned in 1 Corinthians, a man was sleeping with his father's wife and doing so openly, unapologetically, as a member of the church. Paul had to come forcefully against that behavior and teaching. And there were other false ideas going around, too, in his churches that he was constantly battling against. So Paul lived in a culture gone crazy, a morally dark culture. How did he handle it? Well, a writing of his popped into my mind last week as I was considering the state of our world today. Paul wrote these comments to his fellow Christ followers in Philippians chapter 2. He said, "Do everything without grumbling or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation. Then you will shine among them like stars in the sky as you hold firmly to the word of life." Paul experienced the society of his day as being a warped and crooked generation, and so he offered some advice to other fellow Christians also living at that time and place. And what did he tell them to do? Well, his first recommendation there was to not grumble or complain. We should not grumble or complain. Now, life was throwing terrible things at a lot of these Christians. Crazy, unjust, brutal, murderous things. There would have been plenty for those Christians to complain about. But Paul said, don't do it. Don't complain. Stay above it. Detach yourself from the madness to some extent. Keep your head out of that mess. So, yeah, don't pick up a complaining spirit. Stay positive. Stay godly. Stay hopeful. Don't grumble or complain. Then he had a second suggestion in that Philippians passage. It was that we ought to seek to live as morally pure of a life as we can. Seek to become, he wrote there, blameless and pure, children of God without fault. Okay, now, we know that Paul didn't actually expect the people he was writing to live perfectly without sin. Paul has some of the most famous passages in the Bible about how Christ followers continue to be plagued by sin to some extent even after being saved by Jesus. But he also wrote passages like this one where he asks us to give sinless living the best effort we've got. Not only does sinless living honor and show love to the one who has saved us, but it keeps us and our loved ones from experiencing the negative effects of sin. And so Paul in this passage here seems to be saying that the best thing a person can do when they are surrounded by immorality is to be moral. Best thing a person can do when they're surrounded by immorality is to be moral. If all those around us rejoice in darkness, it's all the more important that Christ followers live in the light of Jesus and let his light flow through us so that, as Paul wrote there, we might shine among them like the stars. I'd like to add in there that we are to live morally, as morally pure as we can, and We are to do so humbly. Paul doesn't say it here, but elsewhere he echoes Jesus' oft-repeated calls in Scripture to be humble. So please don't get the idea that we are to combat rising immorality around us by living pure lives and then sticking it in everybody's face. Yeah. We're to live morally pure lives and do so humbly. Reminds me of that passage that Pastor Larry Osborne was working from in the sermon of his we looked at back in January. It was this passage from the Apostle Peter who wrote, "Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect." So let's be humble and not arrogant or in your face. We ought to seek to live as morally pure of a life as we can, and we should do so humbly. Third point that I think we can take away from how Paul determined to live within what he called the warped and crooked generation around him. And it's this. We should live in ways that will win as many as possible to Jesus. We should live so as to win as many as possible to Jesus. 1 Corinthians 9. "Though I am free and I belong to no one," Paul wrote, "I've made myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do all of this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings." Now, we would actually probably need to spend some substantial time to make sure that we fully understood everything that Paul was saying there, and I'm not going to do that today. Although I will tell you one thing that Paul does not mean when he said there that he becomes all things to all people. He does not mean that he would go sin in order to make connections with sinners. We just saw point number two was he asks us to live as morally pure of a life as we can. So he does not mean that. The point of this passage is that Paul was 100% focused on engaging with the people around him, the people of that warped and crooked generation, in order that he might share the good news of Jesus with them, in order that some might be saved from the lost path they were on. And this passage shows that Paul was strategic in going about this. You know, he was thinking ahead. He was going to think ahead about how he might best act and talk in order to successfully communicate about Jesus with Jews, about Jesus with non-Jews. With a creative plan and an unwavering passion, Paul was determined to live in a morally lost culture by trying to help people who were living lost in that culture become found. He was sold out to helping people in darkness find light. "I've become all things to all people," he said, "so that by all possible means I might save some in order to win as many as possible to Christ." If you've read the book of Acts, you'll see Paul he visited city after city, and each time he got to a new city, first thing he did was find the synagogue and go in and teach to the Jews there about Jesus. Now, you may recall that the Jews are the ones who killed Jesus. This was a bold and brave thing Paul was doing. And it wasn't only the Jews he was interested in telling about Jesus. After visiting the synagogue, Paul would often go into the marketplace where Jews and non-Jews would be present, and he would teach about Jesus there as well. So Paul responded to living in the morally lost culture he was in, not by hiding away from it, but by engaging it. And I'm going to go back again to Larry Osborne and that great point that he had for us in the sermon we looked at weeks ago. Remember, he said, "Christians, we cannot have impact without contact. We can't have impact without contact." Yeah, the culture around us is getting less and less godly, and the natural reaction for those who are wanting to live in godly ways might be to pull away and hide. But Pastor Osborne said, no, we can't live in holy huddles if we are trying to win as many as possible, right? Well, I really like this quote from him as well. Pastor Osborne said, "Obedience to Jesus' command to make disciples of all nations is not found in isolation. Obedience is found in infiltration." Obedience is not found in isolation, it's found in infiltration. So if we're wanting to learn from Paul and how he felt a Christ follower ought to live and the difficult situations that he found himself in, we cannot miss that Paul sought to live in ways that would win as many as possible for Jesus Christ. And we should do this too. Before I offer some points of or words of application, let me just summarize the 3 points we've gathered from this brief look at the Apostle Paul here on how to live within a morally lost culture. We'll just summarize it quick. So Paul said, don't grumble or complain, right? Even if we have good reason to grumble and complain, don't do it. Stay above it. Detach yourself from the madness around you, and I am not saying detach yourself from the people around you. Just saying detach yourself somewhat from the madness. Don't pick up a complaining spirit. Stay positive. Don't grumble or complain. Second suggestion was to live as morally pure of a life as you can. The best thing a person can do when they're surrounded by immorality is to be moral, to be light in the darkness. We are to live as morally pure of a life as we can, and we should do that humbly. And then lastly, Paul modeled for us that we should seek to live so as to win as many as possible to Jesus Christ. Okay, application. You actually don't need me to apply these concepts to the various situations you encounter in your lives. That's something you'll just naturally do if these things have been meaningful to you. So I'm just going to make one application point for us this morning. Okay, listen to me, everybody. I'm going to bring up politics again here. I really believe that I'm not about to say anything that is going to upset anyone. I dearly hope that anyway. Okay, I dearly hope that, that's true. I've been wrong about that in the past. This is a sermon about how Christians should handle living in an increasingly dysfunctional culture. American politics is part of the increasing dysfunction that we're facing. So I think that spending a little time to apply some of these principles that we've been looking at to how we ought to be reacting to what's going on politically in our country makes sense for us here. So yes, I'm bringing up the subject again. I promise, though, to leave the politics topic alone for a good long time after this one, all right? We'll give you poor people a break. But I really think everyone's going to be fine here, so let's just relax. And actually, I'm interested in your reactions to this. Feel free to chat with me about it later. So, some of this is just me trying to wrap my own brain around some of these things, too. So please, come talk to me later and share your thoughts and reactions. Here we go. So you know well that our country is terribly divided about our president. Our country is terribly divided between Democrat and Republican viewpoints. Every day we're exposed in the news and at times in our conversations with our fellow community members about the, we get exposed to the anger and rage that exists right now about these things. Truth itself seems to be called into question on a daily basis. Both sides of the political spectrum claiming a different understanding of the true story of various events. All of this starts to make life feel unstable and chaotic if you're entering into that on a regular basis. You know, my biggest heartache in all of this is that the anger and the division that we see all around us in our culture seems just as prevalent within the evangelical church. Now, if we were to take the Christian church as a whole in America, that might not surprise us because we already know that the various denominations of churches in this country are divided in opinion upon many, many things. So that might not surprise us. But man, the evangelical church, a movement of churches of which we are a part, one that is unified in holding to the belief, among other things, that the Bible is our ultimate authority and it is to be studied, taken seriously, and applied in our lives. The fact that the evangelical church could be swept up into this political division is troubling to me. And there is a divide. The The media states routinely that the majority of evangelicals thoroughly support our president, and that is correct, largely because of his strong support of the pro-life movement, an ethic that the evangelical church appropriately is deeply committed to. But there also is a significant group of evangelical Christians, people who are starting to become more vocal, who are speaking out against the president, not because they are pro-abortion, but because of certain behaviors of his that are concerning to them. And as this group has become more vocal, it has unleashed a wave of passionate responses from both sides, back and forth, arguments between evangelical Christ followers, and much of this has played out within the view of the secular media, and they've reported on it. If you're a Facebook user, you will know that our Christ-following brothers and sisters also take to social media to vent and fume and argue about these things, often arguing with other Christ followers, and it can get very emotional and it can get bitter. You want to know what this makes me think of? It makes me think of this Bible passage, also from the Apostle Paul. Paul's writing to the members of the church in Corinth here, and he says, "If any of you has a dispute with another, do you dare take it before the ungodly for judgment instead of before the Lord's people? I say this to shame you. Is it possible that there is no one among you wise enough to judge a dispute between believers? But instead, one brother takes another to court, and this in front of unbelievers. The very fact that you have lawsuits among you means you have been completely defeated already. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be cheated?" What does it look like to those who are not following Jesus when Jesus' followers bicker amongst each other? Or in the case that Paul was addressing there, file lawsuits against each other. How is our witness to the goodness of Jesus marred by our arguing amongst ourselves, especially when it's done in view of the wider world? Why not rather be wronged, Paul says, than to have the world around us see us fighting? Remember, this is a man who was focused on doing whatever he could to win as many as possible. The last thing he wanted to see in the church was bickering and infighting, especially if it was viewable to the public. I guess this is what our current situation is making me think of, this political bickering within the evangelical church. You know, we're living, Christians, in a culture that's losing it, but we are letting the culture's dysfunction invade the church rather than standing together against it. We cannot allow the anger and division in our country right now infect us personally or infect the church. We should not participate in public barrages against our fellow Christ followers. Boy, it seems to me, you know, if we all share the same handbook for life, and we do, it's called the Bible, that members of the evangelical church should be able to come together as the church and say that we stand for a full set of biblical values, something like this, okay? We stand for the protection of all life, including the unborn. We stand for the idea that all people ought to have a strong work ethic. But we also stand for showing compassion to the poor and the downtrodden. Both those things are biblical. We together stand for showing respect to women, for showing respect to minorities. We believe that slander is wrong. We all desire for our country to protect us from our enemies. We all want our leaders to make decisions that will maintain a strong economy in America. We believe in always telling the truth. We in the evangelical church believe that everyone, politician or regular citizen, is to behave ethically and within the law at all times, unless that law would contradict one of God's laws. Okay? No person is above the law of the land. We stand for religious freedom, etc. So, can any Christian argue with any of those values? I don't see how, other than the desire to be protected by our government and to have a strong economy, things that I'm sure we all agree on. Besides those two things, everything that just mentioned there can be clearly drawn from the principles taught in the Bible. These are the values that unite us. So if the Bible is our authority, it seems that we should all be together in lining up behind a full set of values like that. Instead, what I think is happening is that both sides in this political bickering within the church, to some extent, are picking and choosing which of those values we're going to emphasize, and then blasting our brothers and sisters who are emphasizing other things on that list that we're not. Man, why are we not united in something like that? We should be. I know my voice isn't going to get very far out into America today, but for as far as it gets, I guess, I would like to issue a call to the church to not allow the division and anger infecting our culture to infect us. We need to stand together around a complete set of biblical values, and we ought to calmly and lovingly talk through our differences with each other and not in front of the media. Yeah, if we're not to grumble and complain in general, we're certainly not to grumble and complain about each other in the church. Here's a verse we looked at last Sunday. Let's look at it again. 1 Peter 3:9. Do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult. On the contrary, repay evil with blessing. So let's not get into the back and forth. If somebody insults you on Facebook, why not rather just let that be instead of arguing back? Let's not be involved in these heated Facebook posts. Chaos and anger and shifting truth are not characteristics of Jesus Christ, nor should they be characteristics of his followers. Characteristics of Christ include peace and love and a calm, careful, and strong truth. So my application point for us today has been that we can't allow this anger and division in our country infect us personally or infect the church, and I've drawn that point from the principles we've been looking at here this morning, the principle to not grumble or complain, that we're to live in such a way so as to win as many as possible, and then from last week, the encouragement we saw there to respond to the craziness around us by staying calm, by showing love and respect to all, even to those we disagree with. So, we live in an America that's going backwards morally, a troubled society full of anger and division and anxiety and shifting ethics, and things might get more difficult for us, Christ followers, in the future. How vital it is then, my friends, for us to build our lives upon the rock. The one thing that does not move or change in this world is God and the truth he has unfolded for us in his word. God's word has guided so many in the past who lived in difficult situations. And so we can pick up pointers from some of those people to help us in our efforts to navigate life in an America that's moving away from the Bible. We've looked at 7 of those types of recommendations over the past 2 Sundays. I'll summarize them for you one last time, and then we'll close our sermon. How are Christ followers to live within a morally lost culture? 1, we ought to respond to the madness around us by staying calm, though that does not mean staying quiet. 2, we're to show love and respect to all, even to those we're battling ideologically with. 3, we need to be willing to suffer for the right. 4, we should never give up hope. We should never give up on the vision of a better day ahead. And then shifting to today's points from the Apostle Paul. 5, we should not grumble or complain. 6, we ought to live as morally pure of a life as we can, and we should do this humbly. And lastly, 7, we should live in ways that will win as many as possible to Jesus Christ. I hope that these are things that will be helpful to you in your life. Slow and steady. Continue to stand on the rock. Don't allow the cultural storms to infect your life. But that doesn't mean that we hide away, right? We don't hide. In fact, we are to engage, to infiltrate, to seek to win as many as possible to Jesus. And you know what? Who knows? If we do our part in this well, and if the Holy Spirit would give wings to our efforts in the way that we know that he can, then perhaps this situation in America could turn and head back in the other direction. May that be so. Amen.